It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, incumbent Ron Johnson prevailed in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan sailed to an easy victory. A political scientist will dig into the results and what they mean for Wisconsin.
First, a number of issues were up in the air coming into Election Day with a long agenda in place for the new Congress and president.
Now that Donald Trump is the president-elect with majorities in the House and Senate, there are questions about likely priorities and policies from Supreme Court appointments to the Affordable Care Act to trade and immigration.
And then there are the intangible questions. Will the new president and Congress be able to work together after rifts within the Republican Party? And will the new leadership be able to build bridges after a contentious election?
Barbara Perry joins us now. She's a professor of ethics and institutions and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob and Veronica. Good to be with you.
Well, before we get into specific issues, Barbara, let's talk about the divide in this country and what it's going to mean for the new administration. You were quoted in a recent article saying the new president would face maybe the biggest challenge since Abraham Lincoln, 1860, looking at now a virtually ungovernable nation. How so?
Well, we certainly are divided. That's clear from this race and the nature of this campaign. And it's been that way for a number of years. We can go back to Bush v. Gore, for example, that we seem pretty evenly divided, the so-called red and blue states, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives. Some divisions along regional lines, some divisions along education and income lines. And so they're all there. I don't want to put too much emphasis on the ungovernable part of it, but what I meant by that is that I'm a huge admirer of our founding fathers and of our Constitution, and I think that they could never have imagined, no matter how much foresight they had, the role that media, social media, the growth of the electorate, the expansion of the electorate would have in our society, and just what that would mean for our constitutional system. So whereas they had in place all of these mechanisms to try to check the will of the people, as a matter of fact, even the only people who could vote in their day, mostly white male property owners, they still worried about what they called the whims and passions of the people. So Madison wrote in Federalist Paper 51 that if men were angels, no government would be necessary. So they were pragmatist, and they knew that men and now women are not angels, and so they tried to check the devilish nature, perhaps, of human nature. And yet they couldn't have anticipated all of these other elements that are now added into our system that on occasion, I think, do make us somewhat ungovernable. But all I have to do is point to government gridlock to indicate that it's hard for government to govern us.
Let's listen to President-elect Donald Trump in his victory speech talking about trying to patch things up.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me.
So we saw George W. Bush come in with compassionate conservatism. He called himself a uniter, not a divider. President Obama coming in said he'd try to bridge the partisan divide. Didn't come out well in either case. Donald Trump ran a pretty aggressive campaign. A lot of people for and against him saw it as fairly divisive. Could he change to a more positive tone and heal some of these rifts?
Remains to be seen. That's awfully glib, I know, but it does remain to be seen. I think all of these people do have good intentions. I try never to question the motivations of our leaders. I always hope that they are acting in good faith. I noticed that Secretary Clinton mentioned that in her concession speech. So I'm hoping for the best. And if it doesn't happen that these divides are bridged, it doesn't mean that we have to have gridlock. So, for example, and you mentioned Obama saying he wanted to unite the United States and bring together the red and the blue states and to be United States of America. And yet when he came into office, he held the presidency. It was one party. Democrats held the House and the Senate, and he passed through the Affordable Care Act on completely partisan grounds. But nevertheless, he had said that that was at the top of his list. That was at the top of his agenda. People elected him. People elected Democrats to the House and the Senate, and he passed through perfectly allowable partisan agenda. Now it will be up to the Republicans, who can now move forward if they want to repeal that. People have voted for a Republican in the presidency and a House and Senate that are majoritarian Republicans. So I'm never particularly bothered by that. I may not agree with one party or the other, and so I may not put those things at the top of my agenda, but I'm never bothered by one party winning and becoming the majority and putting at the top of the list what they want to do. I just saw the movie All the Way over the weekend about Lyndon Johnson in his first year in office after the assassination of President Kennedy, you know, passing Kennedy's bill. Kennedy had proposed the Civil Rights Bill, which became the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and Lyndon Johnson was able to do that in a bipartisan fashion. Those days may be gone, sadly, but let's hope not.
Talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, getting into policy priorities now for the new administration. And let's get into some of those things that the president and Congress will have to deal with. And let's start with Supreme Court. There is an open seat now. It looks like it will not be filled by Merrick Garland. What are you looking at when Congress is back in session and when Donald Trump nominates, I assume, not Merrick Garland?
I think it's pretty safe to say it will not be Merrick Garland, and that's a shame because he was touted by both Democrats and Republicans. He was viewed as a moderate liberal, to be sure, but nevertheless had high marks from both sides of the aisle. And that would be the sort of thing that would have been a way to show bipartisanship in the nation's capital. But I think you're right that nomination now will die as the Congress goes out of session after the lame duck session. And that Donald Trump was very specific, more so than Secretary Clinton, about the types of people he would put on in terms of names. So he gave out two lists over the campaign of about 10 each. So about 20 names that he's put out, I suspect, that were given to him by the Federalist Society, for example. So these were primarily conservative judges and justices in the lower courts of appeals of the United States federal courts and some state Supreme Courts, about half and half division. It's also interesting to note to me that his sister, Marianne Trump Berry, is a federal judge. So he may have more expertise in this area than people want to give him credit for, but I think it's safe to say it'll be a conservative. But then if we think about the seat that was Justice Scalia's, it will be tit for tat. It'll be a conservative replacing a conservative, no doubt. And I suspect now the only thing is, will the Democrats say, hey, you know, we wanted to have Merrick Garland and you Republicans wouldn't even give him a hearing, so we're going to filibuster. And there's not, the Republicans have a majority, but they don't have a filibuster-proof majority. So it's possible that Democrats, if they are not in a conciliatory mood, could go down that road.
Let's bring on Todd now in Appleton. Todd, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, yes. I was just calling about that very thing because I know that we had both Harry Reid and Tim Kaine on the campaign trail that said that they would, if they got control of the Senate, that they would use the nuclear option without hesitation. If they didn't have a 60-vote majority, they'd use the nuclear option to get their Supreme Court nominees appointed. And nobody seemed to be batting an eye about that. Like, oh my gosh, they wouldn't do that. But when the Republicans, it was suggested several years ago, the Democrats, the Republicans suggested that, and Democrats warned them, oh, you better not, that's way over the top and things like that. So now, you know, I'm wondering how the Democrats and the media are going to treat Republicans if they just decide, well, the hell with your filibuster, we're just going to go with the nuclear option.
Todd, thanks for the call. And the nuclear option being a change of Senate rules to basically eliminate, to take the filibuster out of consideration, allow a majority vote to approve, say, a Supreme Court justice, Barbara. What do you think are the prospects for that?
Yeah, it's possible, to be sure, because they implemented that for the lower federal courts. So for appointments to the circuit courts and the district courts, the trial courts in our federal system, so there is no option now for the filibuster for those. So yeah, there is talk about that as a possibility, and we'll just have to see.
Talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking ahead at important policy decisions lying ahead for President-elect Donald Trump and the Republican Congress.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your hopes and your fears for policy changes in a Trump administration? Is the Affordable Care Act, do you think, likely to go? And do you see that as good news or bad news? Is there any chance of becoming less divided in the next few years? Call in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stay with us. There's more to come.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we continue our conversation with Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking at top policy issues facing the Donald Trump administration and the new Congress.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping changes or doesn't change in health care, immigration, tax reform, trade policy? You name it. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go back to our callers, Barbara, I want to get to a couple more issues you had mentioned. The Affordable Care Act. Donald Trump all along has said repeal this. Republicans have been wanting to repeal and replace it for some time. Do you think it will be, first of all, repealed? And will people come together, the Republicans, on a plan to replace it with something?
I think certainly probably at or near the top of the list for the next president will be an attempt to repeal and perhaps replace that had been in, again, at the near his agenda top for all of this campaign. The question again, will it be able to get through the Senate and not be filibustered to death? We're just going to have to wait and see what kind of mood the Democrats are in, and this would presume unanimity on the part of the Republican Party, which is not necessarily a safe assumption, but I would presume that this would be an issue along with the Supreme Court justice around which most Republicans on the Hill and the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue could come together. Again, though, the sticking point will be the possibility of filibustering all of these things and not even getting them back to the desk of the new president.
Another big issue that could be a point of friction between Donald Trump and some Republicans in Congress is trade policy. A lot of Republicans have supported international trade agreements, kind of a pro-business plank as they see it. Donald Trump obviously ran against current and potential future trade deals. How do you see that issue playing out?
Yeah, I think that's going to be, as you say, that's going to be a different kettle of fish from certainly from the Supreme Court nomination and the Affordable Care Act, that this is one that there is not consensus right now in the Republican Party. So I presume that Trump, if he follows the promises that he made on the campaign trail, will try to go down this road on TPP, for example, and maybe even try to roll back things like NAFTA. Whether he can get a majority of his own party to approve of that remains to be seen. It's going to be fascinating to see if this person who prides himself on being able to do the art of the deal, this is exactly where the art of the deal is required, and that is to get with the pin. This is where somebody like a Lyndon Johnson was just superb at arm twisting and back scratching and all of the things that went into getting people over to his side, no matter what side of the aisle they were on. So we'll see if Donald Trump is able to do that.
Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just want to say, as a Hillary, as a person who voted for Hillary Clinton, I always looked upon her as a deeply flawed candidate because she did not have an overriding theme or vision for her candidacy. I mean, Donald Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left had a populist message. And I think that's one of the messages or points that the Democratic Party must look at when planning for the future, be it Senator Warren or someone else as a standard bearer, because her entire campaign struck me, or theme was, well, I'm not Donald Trump. And that isn't always a reason for people to vote for you. And I'll hear the your professor's answer off the air. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. And Barbara, what do you think of what Republicans are going to be doing while they are out of power in all chambers of power in Washington?
Yeah, what Democrats are going to be doing as the out party we'll see. It's going to be fascinating. I take Jim's point, and this was a common criticism of Secretary Clinton, that while she was always viewed as the policy wonk and she could get down into the weeds of policy and have all the details, and I thought that she always did fine with that, going back to her days of pushing, unsuccessfully, but pushing for health care reform as First Lady. And so she was able to do that in the debates and on the stump. But Jim is right to say what she was missing was that vision, the so-called vision thing that George H.W. Bush used to mention that he was accused of not having. And I think part of that, too, is that the Clintons themselves, certainly starting with Bill Clinton, remember the third way, that he was the moderate liberal, moderate Democrat. And while he was able to pull that off, I don't think that she was. And I think she was trying to straddle between moderation and trying to bring in the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party and the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. And it ended up feeling diluted rather than having a clear, crisp vision. The question now will be which direction will the party go? Will it now sort of tack back leftward towards the wing of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders?
Thanks for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking at the results of yesterday's election and what it means moving forward, especially in terms of policy for the Republican president and Congress. An announcement, Myron Ebell, who's director of the Center for Energy and Environment with the Conservative Competitive Enterprise Institute, he's going to be the EPA transition leader. This is someone who has not believed in the general scientific consensus of global warming, has opposed anti-global warming message. Is Donald Trump has spoken out against global warming. Is this a pretty strong signal that the United States' approach to climate change and energy is going to change?
It certainly sounds like it. To put someone like that, who is thinking, I guess, as Donald Trump does, that global warming is a hoax and is not scientifically proven, or, there are those who think that global warming is happening, but it's not necessarily caused by human behavior. It is part of a cycle of climate. I thought that science had debunked that, but apparently not to Donald Trump's satisfaction, and it sounds like that's where he's going to go in his environmental policy.
Let's go to another caller now. Steve is with us in Green Bay. Steve, hi.
Hi there. I was actually wanting to have a comment because the big theme for the right in the last 8 years has basically been we don't want to do anything. It was a big message of tear down the Affordable Care Act, stop this, stop that. So now that the ball's in their court, I guess, from a top-down perspective, I guess what's the professor's take on what is going to be put forward? Do we have any idea what the alternative, where the movement is going to go? Because so far it seemed like the only thing being espoused was we just don't want anything to happen. So,
gotcha, Steve. So Republicans moving from the outside party in terms of the White House and obstructionist, they were accused of and sometimes admitted to. They wanted to thwart President Obama's agenda. Well, now they own the place. What is going to be the transition there from opposition to trying to get stuff done?
Yeah, I think that raises such a fascinating question because there was both that kind of mainstream Mitch McConnell Republicanism that was we're fighting to make Barack Obama one-term president, and we just were going to be obstreperous and obstructionist. And yet that also was, I think, the caller's point perhaps about the Tea Party. So remember when the Tea Party comes in as a response to a blowback to the Affordable Care Act in 2010 in the midterms, that they really do seem totally obstructionist, that's all that they care about is obstructionism. So again, this, I think, goes back to the now now the different elements and factions within the Republican Party are there. I don't think that Mitch McConnell exists to be obstructionist, but he did to obstruct Democrats. I think if he has an agenda that he would like to move forward, he'd be fine with that. But I have always wondered, how does one deal with an opposition not on policy but on the very existence of government and what government should do or not do, and the choice would be have it do nothing. And then my question is always, have it do nothing until what? Until a tornado hits your town, a hurricane hits your town, your crops fail because of a terrible climate situation. It's always interesting to me how some people don't want government to do anything until they're immediately impacted by a disaster.
Steve, thanks for the call. Go next to Saeed in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to contrast the nominating process of the two parties and how that, I think, eventually controlled the outcome. On the Republican side, the Republican establishment had almost no control over the process. It was very much driven by the organic grassroots activities. The Republicans criticized that and lamented how they ended up with the nominee, which many viewed as imperfect. But it was driven by grassroots. Then you look at the Democratic side and how the DNC very much controlled the process. Superdelegates played a very, very big role. And now we know that actually the DNC was in collusion with the Clinton campaign to eliminate that grassroots candidacy of Bernie Sanders. And I think that, at the end, is the controller of the outcome.
Saeed, interesting point. So, Barbara, a lesson maybe for Democrats is the Republicans, to a greater extent than the Democrats, let primary voters determine the outcome. Democrats didn't. Look who won.
Yeah, this is in a campaign that's been so topsy-turvy, with everything stood on its head and seemingly no common wisdom being either wise or common or applicable. I think this is one of the most fascinating to me as a political scientist, and that is that you have these two parties that, as the caller said, did things oppositely in terms of how they chose their candidate, and the irony is that the Republican establishment thought, oh, we are headed down such a bad road. We will never be able to. We don't want this man, and we'll never be able to elect him. And what do they do now that he's been elected? Do they say, oh, well, you know, never mind. That's okay. You know, our party's in control, so we'll just go with that. And what do the Democrats do? Is this a kind of reverse of what happened after the George McGovern debacle and lost to a landslide in 1972 to Nixon, when superdelegates were placed into the mix by the Democratic Party establishment to make sure that they were picking more moderate, more establishment people?
Always fighting the last war. Barbara Perry, thanks for joining us today. That's Barbara Perry, professor of ethics and institutions at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Republicans maintain their majorities in both houses of Congress. We'll have a recap of results from key congressional races around the country and an analysis of where polling went wrong with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First, we're breaking down election results last night in the U.S. House and Senate races in Wisconsin. All of the incumbents in Wisconsin's congressional races won, except for the 8th district race, where Republican Representative Reed Ribble retired. Even in Wisconsin's Senate race, where polls showed Democratic challenger and former Senator Russ Feingold with a tight lead, the incumbent Republican Ron Johnson was victorious.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about Wisconsin's congressional races? If you were in that 8th district, viewed as a possible switch, ended up being a fairly handy victory for the Republican there. What did you make of that race in that area? And the race for the Senate, Ron Johnson, Russ Feingold. Were you happy with the outcome? I'm surprised by it. What did the Republicans do right, do you think? What should Democrats have done differently there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Tim Dale joins us now to talk about these races and their outcomes. He's an associate professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Wisconsin's Senate race. So were you surprised that incumbent Ron Johnson eventually won the day yesterday?
Well, the polls ended up being essentially tied going into yesterday. And so I don't think either outcome would have been surprising because of how close the polls were. I think that there were some surprises overall on the night. Of course, Donald Trump did much better than what his polls were showing he would do. And I think given that, it's not too much of a surprise that Johnson did well in Wisconsin. I think the big surprise probably is the margin by which Johnson won, which puts it slightly outside the margin of error for the last poll that we saw. And he did better than Donald Trump did in the state of Wisconsin, which shows that there were voters who didn't vote for Trump but voted for Ron Johnson, and not a small amount. So I think that is probably more of the surprise is the margin that Johnson won, not necessarily that he won.
Yeah, that race was an interesting trajectory there. At the beginning of the race, we had polling that showed Feingold with a pretty hefty lead over incumbent Ron Johnson. And it seems as though as time went along, that lead got smaller and smaller, tapered off to that statistical dead heat that you were talking about. How do you explain that? What happened?
Well, what was interesting about that race is that aside from a narrowing that normally happens as like election day gets closer, which I think explains some of it, I think the Johnson campaign effectively reminded people that Feingold wasn't necessarily an outsider, wasn't challenging the idea that we needed someone new to bring in. So a lot of Johnson's campaign messaging was focused on Feingold's political history. And so I think Johnson may have effectively neutralized the argument that Johnson used the first time that Feingold tried to use, which is that we needed someone new in the seat. And so I think that may be where Johnson was successful in terms of convincing people that there really wasn't an option in that particular race for people who wanted change as opposed to keeping things the same.
And what about spending by outside groups, especially at the end there? A lot of money coming into this particular race in Wisconsin. What kind of difference did it make, if any?
It may have made a difference. I think people probably recognized that in the final days of the campaign, we saw essentially every single ad on television as a political ad. In fact, I know television stations in the state were a little worried going into November that they weren't going to make their advertising targets. And then suddenly in November, there was this huge amount of money poured into the state of Wisconsin. I think that probably had an impact, although looking overall, again, I think it may not have impacted who won that race. It may have impacted the margin by which Johnson ended up pulling it out.
And what do you think it is about the arguments? You talked a little bit about the arguments that Ron Johnson made against Russ Feingold that you think got some traction. What about the arguments that Feingold tried to make in his stead that Johnson was a business person who had maybe taken money to pay himself and also tried to paint him as sort of an insider? He's been there for a little bit. Why didn't those arguments take hold?
Well, I think that they probably took hold in terms of Feingold doing essentially as well as Clinton did among the voters. His numbers actually match almost identically to Hillary Clinton voters in the state. But I don't think that they were enough to convince that additional set of voters who were probably voting on other issues, other kind of bigger picture questions. And so I think really looking back on this particular election, it's going to be remarkable that Republicans did so well across the country. And in Wisconsin in particular, in this Senate race, for now several election cycles, we've been saying that presidential years favor Democrats in Wisconsin in terms of turnout, and midterm elections favor Republicans. There are a lot of ways in which our election day yesterday proved that Wisconsin is becoming a red state. And that's something that people have been asking me for a while, with Scott Walker as governor and some successful Republicans running in Wisconsin. But really, yesterday showed that Republicans in Wisconsin can out-turn out Democrats in a presidential year. And I think that wave, probably more than any particular issue or argument, is what really captured this race.
As we've been talking about, incumbent Senator Ron Johnson kept his seat. Here's a little bit of his victory speech. Mm-hmm.
So I approach the next 6 years with a seriousness of purpose. We've got a shot. We've got a chance. We've got to put America on the right path. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to be concentrating on the areas of agreement.
Okay, there we heard from incumbent Senator Ron Johnson, who kept that seat. And back to back here, here's a little bit from Democrat Russ Feingold's concession speech.
This could be one of the most challenging times in the history of our country. And it's going to be up to you, particularly these wonderful young people that worked on this campaign. You're going to have to heal the wounds. You're going to have to bring us together. We will get through this, and I look forward to helping you in any way I can. But it is now up to you.
Feingold saying there, it's up to you, sort of giving the impression that there's still work to be done, both in healing and also maybe referencing a Democratic agenda left unfinished there. How do you think that that statement reads to Democrats and to other people watching?
Right. Well, I think it reflects the overall tone of the night for Democrats, which is a loss across the board. And essentially, in terms of national politics, Congress and the presidency, Democrats don't have any power. And so as a truly now a minority party that is going to be the opposition party, both to the president and in Congress, I think Democrats probably have less work to do than the Republicans in terms of framing the agenda. But certainly the path forward is going to have to be one that Democrats ask about.
We're talking with political scientist Tim Dale right now from UW-La Crosse, talking about Wisconsin's congressional races, including, of course, the U.S. Senate race. And we were talking earlier about who won here in Wisconsin. And it was a surprising result with the presidential election. A lot of pundits and analysts said that Americans wanted change, and that's why Donald Trump was elected. He was anti-establishment. But then you look at other races last night in Wisconsin, and including that one, and the winners were all incumbents except for one race where the candidate of the incumbents party won. But what does that say about what Wisconsinites want? Is there a disconnect there?
There might be, particularly on the surface of the question, do people want change? I think the fact that Johnson outperformed Trump in the state of Wisconsin indicates that this election was about more than just the presidential race. And I think as we look back on the turnout, I think that there was the change argument on the presidential side that probably drove a lot of people to the polls. But the Republican Party, I think, more effectively made an argument to voters, and this is one of the things that was unpredicted about yesterday, actually did a better job of turning out their voters. There were a number of Democrats who didn't vote yesterday, and that really made it so that the Republican turnout effort, even though it wasn't necessarily the Trump campaign that was getting people to turn out, the Republican Party really drove their voters to the polls. And I think that really is the story from yesterday. It's about Republican turnout, and it's about Republican messaging. In part, that messaging is about change, but that messaging also has to do with the purpose of government and an argument against the Democratic Party and the politics that Hillary Clinton and the Democrats were advancing.
So you're saying that Republican voters turned out because there was a crisper message on the Republican side, something that was kind of easy to sink your teeth into, whereas it was maybe a little more diffuse on the Democratic side?
Well, this is what was, I think it's an excellent question. This is what was interesting about, and I think one of the big paradoxes of the polls going into yesterday and then the result that we saw is that Barack Obama enjoys a fairly high approval rating. And so it's over 50%. And so with over 50% approval rating for an incumbent party in the presidency, you would think that they would have performed better. And perform better, particularly in states that have been voting Democratic for a while. So as we look at the map right now, it's not just Wisconsin, it's also Michigan and Pennsylvania. And so I think that there was an argument that was made by Republicans, both at the top of the ticket in Trump and some Republicans running. And some of these messages are things like messages against free trade, where the Democratic Party, under Barack Obama and Democrats who are running, were making equivocated arguments on things about like free trade. And so I think that's where there may have been a crisper argument for Republicans, and it was a reversal from where we have seen the Republican Party in recent memory. But it's a reversal that seemed to really resonate with Republican voters.
Political scientist Tim Dale's with us now. He's from UW La Crosse, and we're talking about Wisconsin's congressional races, including the U.S. Senate race.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think so many incumbents won in Wisconsin when it comes to the congressional races, districts around the state? What did you think about your congressional race, your representative, and the U.S. Senate race was the second biggest ticket item here in Wisconsin after the presidential race. Were you excited about it? Were you enthusiastic about Ron Johnson or Russ Feingold? What did you make of the outcome? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about congressional races in Wisconsin now with Tim Dale of UW La Crosse.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. In those congressional races, in the race for the Senate, what are your thoughts on the outcomes here in Wisconsin? Were you surprised that incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson won his second term in the Senate? What did you think of the candidacy of Russ Feingold, former senator on the Democratic side? Was it a good call for the Democrats to go with him? Should they be looking for new blood in races like this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got David with us in Burlington. David, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for the show. I always enjoy it.
Thank you.
Say, Mr. Dale, I wanted to take issue with something you said earlier, that you thought the Republicans did a good job of getting the voter turnout, and I don't think that was the case myself. I think that they benefited from the presidential race, and that the conservative voters turned out to vote against Hillary, and they were also there, as long as they're there, they're voting for a Republican ticket. I don't think the Republicans did a very good job at all. Johnson didn't do a good job at all for wanting me to vote for him. I don't know who he is. I like Russ. But I really believe that the huge turnout was to make sure Hillary didn't become president. She lost the election. Trump didn't win it.
David, thank you for that. And what do you think of that? He's flipping it around a little on you, Tim. He's saying that Democrats didn't do a great job getting people out, but that Republicans just voted against Hillary Clinton, and that's what got them there, sort of motivated by the negative prospect of Clinton rather than the positive of Trump.
Right. Well, so if we look at the numbers for president in Wisconsin from 2012, we see that Mitt Romney got 1.4 million votes in Wisconsin in 2012. Last night, on the count as it stands right now, Donald Trump has 1.4 million votes. So he essentially has the same votes as Mitt Romney in the state of Wisconsin. We could say that Mitt Romney and Donald Trump had the same basic performance. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, has 1.3 million votes, and Barack Obama won 1.6 million votes in 2012. Looking at those numbers, what we see is that for the election that happened yesterday, Republicans were able to get their people to the polls. Now, whether that happens through a motivation against a presidential candidate, whether that happens as a motivation for a particular candidate, those numbers show that Republicans were successful. And the relatively low numbers for Hillary Clinton shows the Democrats were not successful at getting their people to the polls. I think as a second point, and I agree with the caller, I think there are a lot of things that motivated people to the polls. But Ron Johnson outperformed Donald Trump in the state of Wisconsin, which meant that there were more people voting for Ron Johnson than voted for Donald Trump. It wasn't just a presidential issue. There were likely people who either voted for Hillary Clinton or for no one for president and also voted for Ron Johnson. So I think those are some factors that led to the higher Republican turnout last night.
David, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we're going to go to Todd next in Eau Claire. Todd, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. My statement was between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold. It seemed to me that Russ Feingold's whole platform was based on what Ron Johnson making $10 million off his own business, the business that he had run. The actual net effect of his statements, his campaign, and what he had to say, I think it missed what the voters were saying, what the people were actually saying about jobs and about the Obamacare and just how poor the take-home pay is to Americans. And Russ Feingold, I think he just missed a boat. Ron Johnson kept talking about where he wants to take the nation, what we need to do. I just felt strongly that Ron Johnson outperformed.
Todd, thanks a lot for that. And Todd saying, again, that kind of a similar case as we were saying before, perhaps Donald Trump had a crisper vision. He's sort of saying that same thing, that Feingold lacked that crisp vision, and he saw that vision in Ron Johnson. What do you think about that analysis, Tim?
Right, and I think the caller is right, but I think both sides had their share of attack ads that they were running and attacks that they were running, and part of a campaign is typically to cast doubt on the character or the judgment of the person that that is being run against the candidate of choice. But I think part of the story is also what your caller explained, and that is that Johnson kind of tapping in, particularly toward the end of the campaign, to the energy behind a Donald Trump candidacy, I think on the issues resonated with voters in a way, particularly voters willing to vote Republican, that we haven't seen Johnson, for Republicans anyway, for several election cycles.
Well, we've got to talk about Paul Ryan before we're through here in the 1st Congressional District, how Speaker Paul Ryan easily won. What's your takeaway from that particular race?
So Paul Ryan is as a candidate is very successful and is a strong candidate. There was no doubt that he would be able to maintain his seat. As Speaker of the House, however, I think that's where our conversation is going to be going, and we would be looking for the next several weeks and months. And that is, he has a very difficult leadership position. Not difficult in the sense that if you're the Speaker of the House, you want your candidate to win the presidency. But there are several things that Paul Ryan disagrees with Donald Trump about. And so the Democratic Party has some soul searching to do because they had a bad night last night. The Republican Party has some soul searching to do because they won. But they won in some cases where the candidates running for office actually hold different views than the candidate who won for president. And so it is going to be a challenge for Paul Ryan in Congress, interesting to see how he uses his leadership position to bring the party together when there may be some substantial disagreements happening between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump in the presidency.
Right. So what do you think is going to happen there? I mean, does Paul Ryan just kind of pretend that the last year didn't happen and go forward and embrace Trump? Or does he sort of try to hang on to some of what he was saying, that, you know, he'll stand up when he disagrees with Donald Trump and be that voice?
Right. I think the latter is probably what you're going to see happen more often. And typically it happens because the Congress has a different set of constitutional priorities, but also political priorities, and they answer to the electorate in a different way than the presidency. So I would expect that there may be some disagreements. I think the conversations happening between Donald Trump and Paul Ryan going forward may work some of that out behind the scenes. But I think that there are a couple of different scenarios. You could see some big public battles between Trump and Congress, and even the Republican Congress. But you also may see Trump back off some of his positions and essentially let Congress have some more power. Maybe even we've even seen Congress have in the past. So it'll be an interesting thing to watch going forward, certainly.
Ryan also thanked Donald Trump for the Republican majority in Congress, something that Paul Ryan said he was deeply invested in, more than getting Trump elected at certain points. So here's a little bit of what he said.
Our House majority is bigger than expected. We won more seats than anyone expected, and much of that is thanks to Donald Trump. Donald Trump provided the kind of coattails that got a lot of people over the finish line so that we could maintain our strong House and Senate majorities.
And that's an interesting one from Paul Ryan, out of the mouth of Paul Ryan, who at various points during this campaign said, well, I'm going to focus on keeping majorities in the House, keeping Republicans in the House, and sort of said, well, Donald Trump, you're kind of on your own right now. I'm going to focus over here instead. Now we've got this thank you saying the opposite came true last night. Where do you think that leaves both Donald Trump and Paul Ryan?
Well, I think this also falls in the category of one of the things that happened yesterday. For a long time, we were talking about fear that Republicans had down the ballot that Donald Trump may suppress turnout, may turn Republicans off, may cause some ballot splitting that may endanger some Republican seats. And it turns out, by the end of the night, I suppose it was the wee hours of the morning, what we saw yesterday was essentially the opposite. Donald Trump drove turnout and caused some Republicans to be successful that we weren't necessarily expecting would be successful. And so I think that is part of what Ryan is appreciative of, is that Donald Trump, despite conventional wisdom and predictions, really drove some Republican turnout that they were afraid wouldn't end up materializing on Election Day.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Tim Dale, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW La Crosse, and he joined us there to recap Wisconsin's congressional races. And you can find more election coverage and analysis over at wisconsinvote.org.
And you can still share your thoughts on Wisconsin's congressional and Senate races, the presidential election, the state assembly and Senate. Head over to our vast social media enterprises. Well, that's two things, at Central Time WPR if you're on Twitter, or you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We have a bunch of links and discussion starters there, so do chime in. And if you need a break from politics, we've got a handy list of 10 great trails to go hiking on around the state of Wisconsin. We've got that link there. You could check off the ones you've already done and maybe make a plan to get out there and enjoy the weather and take a break from the computer screen this weekend.
This is Central Time.